Today's show guest, Eric Robinson's opinions and comments are his own and not a reflection of the companies he is currently working for and has worked for in the past.
It was my dad took me to this computer show, and I remember it was Apple there, and they were talking about this new computer, and I think even Steve Jobs was there, actually.
Nice.
I remember.
Nice.
And I was like, okay.
Hello, community. Welcome to another episode of Devs Like Us. Today, we have a special guest joining us, Eric Robinson. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Awesome. So we'll go ahead and get started. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey and where you come from?
Sure. So first of all, I hope everyone and your family is doing well and staying safe during these unpredictable times of strife. And I wanted again to thank you for inviting me to the show. I'm a big fan, and I'm just so proud to be part of such a professional and part of the medium that you provide to everyone and to the community of like-minded folks like ourselves. And we're just talking about the new hashtag, right? Always learning, right? Which I think I did steal from my mom, actually. But currently, I am vice president, and I head of a product and platform strategy for a company called Centellus. It's a company that provides customer experiences-driven planning solutions that help companies within verticals like healthcare, higher education, financial institutions, and other verticals to transform their vision into sustainable a value creation type of model. And we have over 400 employees, about 500,000 users of our platform. So it's really my job to continue sustaining that growth through looking at new forward ways and innovation by driving the product strategy. So my career spans close to nearly two decades now, and includes extensive leadership in product development and management, and with this focus on this new area that everyone's talking about, but I'm talking about it about 5 years ago, called Dietary Management. It's an extension around Agile and DevOps space. And prior to joining Centellus, I served in a product leadership position for the organization, for other organizations and startups, and they're all acquired by the likes of HP, Cisco, and Google. For that one. So from a journey standpoint, let me see if I can be brief about that one. So I am from St. Louis. I'm from the Midwest. So used to the cold. I'm in Texas right now. So it's a fairly cold, but it's still not to the level of where I'm from in St. Louis. I'm the oldest of 10 children.
Oh, nice.
Five brothers, four sisters, small house, kind of like the Jacksons, but but no one can sing.
I was going to say, can you sing?
Oh, man.
And so our parents. definitely missed opportunity for sure. Our parents were entrepreneurs. So many of my brothers and sisters inherited that trait. I kind of did a little bit of that. But growing up, sometimes business is good, sometimes business is bad, right? And you had to adapt to that. And so growing up in an environment, we definitely had an environment where it wasn't, it was some struggle here and there for that. But our parents always instill education into us, and they also were educated in their area and domains. However, the company was very unique. We basically sold and repaired commercial ovens. So back then, in the restaurants and bakeries and large stores, I don't know where you guys are from, but maybe if you have a Kroger, or maybe you guys got a Piggly Wiggly. I don't know.
Yes, I'm familiar with the Piggly Wiggly.
My parents had a Piggly Wiggly where they're from, but I've been there, but not where I'm from.
I love Piggly Wiggly when I go visit my mom. And so what they would do is They had large, they were not like the ovens that you see in your house. They were like very large ovens that filled up half the room. And so we would sell and repair them. And my dad was always into technology. And so whenever we had a little extra money, he would purchase computer magazines. So those computer magazines during the mid-80s was very interesting because at that time, it was basically two groups. There was the rise of the video game consoles, like the Ataris and the ColecoVisions, way before the Sonys for sure. And then you had the advent of home personal computers from companies like Commodore. And they had computers like VIC-20 and Commodore 64. And then Atari started even coming out with their own PCs. But Apple had one. And of course, IBM launched their PCs, but they're very expensive. And Apple's pretty expensive as well. So we couldn't afford that, but my dad did buy a Commodore VIC-20 and a 64. And back during those days, it was very little amount of K. It was only like 64K. That's what they called it. Commodore 64. Actually, the VIC-20 had only 5K. So imagine just 5K, and you know, you look at your phone here, it's like night and day, right? And also back then, we didn't have disk. We didn't have the disk or the hard drive or the floppies. We had actually, ironically, I still have it here.
This is our first nice prop on the show. I just want to say thank you for doing that. This is awesome. You're so prepared. That is awesome.
It's right here. It has my first program on it, and it was amazing just being able to save that at the time, because early on we couldn't type back then in the computer magazines. You had the program and you would type it in hand by hand, right? And couldn't load anything, download anything or anything from that nature. And so you had to be you had to check it and be very close. So
I love the fact that you have a great amount of hardware like in your background, because a lot of times today, especially like from the computer science standpoint, I had to intentionally like seek out buying like the Arduinos and the little different pieces of hardware just to see like, hey, my software and code lives there. So did that have an impact? Did you think like, was it hardware that got you into technology with the ovens? Or how do you think, what really made you know that you wanted to get into the field of technology and the value stream mapping and all the other great things that you've been able to do as a result?
That's a fantastic question. So interesting enough, I told you that from the Commodore 60, we got the Commodore 64 because it was very affordable from that standpoint. But at the same time, you also had the Apple II, and then it was my dad took me to this computer show, and I remember it was Apple there, and they were talking about this new computer, and I think even Steve Jobs was there actually.
Nice.
I remember.
Nice.
And was, and I was like, okay, I programmed. I seen some graphics on Commodore 64. I said I haven't seen anything better than that, because I was comparing it to the PCs that I saw, which was just a little DOS prompt and all of that. And then he was demonstrating, he called it the Lisa, Apple Lisa at the time. So it was really, if you remember, it was kind of this desktop, one of the first desktop computers developed by Apple that had the graphical user interface. And it was aimed at the individual business users. And I saw that. And I said, what is that thing that he's moving around? And he's got this cool little window looking, and he's able to drag and drop, and it was interactive. And I was like, I have to get me some of that. That I kind of made that intersection between the hardware and the operating system. And that just really enamored me. And I became enamored with that system, that computer. And Commodore came up with a similar system called the Amiga at the time. And it was pretty advanced for its day because it had the capability to do multitasking. Back then, pretty much all your programs was especially through PC, it was just through this one window, right? And now you were able to have multiple programs running at the same time that didn't interfere with each other and didn't crash the system. And it supported this multi-user OS from the start. And it was just so amazing to me. And then later I saw one of the earlier versions of Windows. I think they came out around 19, I think they were showcasing around 1985. And then I said, is something going on with these IDEs? I didn't call it an IDE at the time. But to me, it offered a new way of being able to create programs and applications that were unique, right? And that's really what got me hooked on that. And I do have a funny story about that, actually. So while growing up, they had this program. It was a busing program, right? It was highly controversial, which at the time. And what they did was it was basically a cultural exchange program. We know what that was or what they were trying to do there. And so what it was is that they would take a group of students from my area, my school, and I lived in the inner city of St. Louis. And they'll take a group of us, some of the top students. I was blessed enough to be part of that group. And we would go out into the schools, to a county school in St. Louis, which was a much more, I would say, affluent area. And then they would come visit us. So we went out there, and I remember asking my friend who I was with, I said, why are we going to the mall? Yeah, I thought we were going to the school because it was like open and sliding doors, automatic doors and escalators. And it was very fancy. And I remember this kid, who was a kid at the time, but we were all kids. He was just such a great guy. And he was so excited to just show me around the school. So he takes me to upstairs, and he takes me to this room, and I immediately notice like all these, at the time they were IBM PCs, but in the corner, they had a Apple Lisa.
Oh, wow.
Which during that time, Apple Lisa was about $10,000. And I said, you have an Apple Lisa. And he said, you know what that is? He said, no one knows what that is. No one uses that. It just sits there. It was donated to us. Somebody donated to us. It's just sitting there in a corner. Nobody uses it. And I was like, wow. Can I use it? but it was so amazing because it immediately I saw that it was here. You had this $10,000 computer that really no one kind of knew what it was. I knew what it was, but I didn't have access to it, right? And I was like, I wish I could get it. It was a very interesting and eye-opening experience for me at the time because I thought that was just purely out of reach of everybody, right? Except for the businesses and things of that nature. So My dad saw that I had this interest. And so because of him standing in the code, and I always am so grateful for him for doing this. So back then they had these magnet schools, very early at magnet schools. I think they do have them now, but it was a special academic school for math and science. And they did have the resources, like that school I visited. They didn't have Appaloosa, but they had Macintoshes, earlier versions of the first Apple Macintoshes. And even more importantly, they had advanced courses in programming. Okay. And it was a very diverse school. So it's incredible. We had African Americans, we had children from across the world, and it was very diverse. And so I got to interact with different groups of people, and I had access now to the resources. And I remember my professor was just so enamored because I already knew programming, and they were like, how did you learn that? And I said, well, you know, I taught myself. It was basic programming. And so I was able to skip a lot of the earlier classes and focus on some of the higher level programming classes. They were called Pascal. They used the Pascal language at the time. If you remember, I don't know if you're exposed to BASIC during that time, but earlier versions of BASIC, which, by the way, the BASIC for Commodore was actually developed and licensed by this small company called Microsoft.
That's funny you say small.
Yeah, during that time. Well, small company. After the IBM deal, they kind of grew.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Just a tad. The earlier languages, a basic language, it had a go-to statement. And a go-to statement was a control statement that was used to jump to a specific point in the code. And a lot of people probably didn't know this, but C++ and C and even some of the languages like that, they have a go-to statement as well. But the go-to statement was generally considered to be a poor programming practice, right? Because they said it leads to unwieldy programs. Of course, it's always a source of debate around that. And it should always be avoided, right? So I got to started learning best practices, right? Because teaching myself, I just learned pretty much what I saw and what I thought. And being in a formal setting to understand how I just can't start typing the program. I got to start thinking about, start mapping out, well, what am I trying to do? I had to use more critical thinking and analysis and have an approach, have a best practice and start looking at identifying my algorithm, right? And in mathematics, and as you know, in computer science, algorithms just, a finite sequence of instructions typically used to solve specific type of problems, right? And so I became enamored, and this goes to the question also around the language, just the language itself and how that interacted with the hardware and the software, right? And the language was almost, it's like how the sheet of music and then the person uses that sheet of music and uses an instrument to play, right? And depending on how well that music is and how talented that individual is, determines how well that it sounds, right? At least the music I heard, I listened to back in the 80s and 90s. I can't speak to the music that my nieces and nephews listen to.
Yeah. So I love this story, Eric. So So what I'm hearing, so your dad made sure you had the exposure. He saw that you were interested in something. He gave you that exposure. You saw what he had to do in order to get you that exposure. So at a young age, you're already seeing the value of different things, right? And when you're going to this school, the kids there probably didn't know the price of that computer. you knew how much it was, right? Maybe that was because your dad exposed you to it, and he made sure you were aware. So at a young age, I don't know if you're aware, but it's like it seems like you already had the big picture of things at a young age. And so when we're talking about agile, when we're talking about value stream mapping, it's like, what's the big picture? From developers, sometimes we're like, hey, I want to use this library. I want to use this new package just because it's cool, right?
Right.
And so it seems like you and this big picture, you're able to like say, no, like, is what value are we adding at the end of the day? If we're all getting paid, that means we're working for some form of business, right? So why are we doing the things we're doing? Did you know that? Is that why you're in this space now? It's just kind of naturally.
It's so amazing. It's interesting because the first question was really around my journey. And I basically are taking you through steps, right? Kind of the big picture of how I arrive to where I am now, right? And really, to your point, when you're looking at like a value stream mapping, really you're talking about a journey from a current state to where you want to be, right? And I think you bring up the value is very, why the value concept is so relevant, our term is so fundamental, right? Because value is fundamental to everything that an organization does, right? It's the primary reason that our organization exists is to provide value to one or more stakeholders, right? It's the foundation of a company's business model. It describes the rationale for how a business creates, delivers, and captures that value, right? And what happened is that after COVID, and we started to see value starting to take a different meaning, right? Because of the social dynamics that were taking place and the rise of empathy and the rise of having diverse voices of value now being connected to the human experience, right? Businesses had to recognize that, the human experience goes well beyond the four walls of the organization that they're in, right? It includes their customers, their workforce, their business partners, right? So it's interesting because people that they may have considered relevant as a consumer only are now becoming producers as well, right? And what was happening is that before, that information that they were producing, right, was sometimes utilized without maybe their full awareness, right? But it benefited, let's say, that company, right? And it benefited them in such a way that you were not really getting the benefit. In fact, sometimes it was some could call it some nefarious at times. And so now that's a backlash, right? You're starting to see that backlash on that and saying, hey, I want to better protect my data. I want to better protect, be more aware, be more cognizant of being part of this value stream. I am now part of this value stream, right? So it's more than just a monetary type of definition that was there. So it's important to think of value as a sense of usefulness, benefit, desirability, relativity, rather than this narrow accounting or financial perspective that defines value purely as a material or monetary worth or something, right? And so businesses are now seeing the value of non-monetary examples of value in the business world, right? Which includes such thing as, to the point you make, was I successful in delivering the requested product or service? And did I really resolve the client's problem in a timely manner? And did I provide an experience where that customer felt welcome? Did I incorporate their belief structure, their culture? Were they willing to provide the information to me in order to help me make better decisions, not for just the company, but for them as well, right? So it was taking that information and turning it into useful knowledge. And that's where the value stream mapping really comes into play, because it's really, to boil it down, is a quick and easy way to obtain a snapshot of the entire business, to your point, holistic, right? And since these value streams represent all the work that the business needs to perform and all of the actors that interact with it, right? So at least from that value delivery. So organizations and businesses now, they're becoming value delivery type of organizations. And so that's where the pipeline, the DevOps pipeline kind of comes into to play as well, because essentially what we're talking about is that it helps business leaders assess the organization's effectiveness at creating, capturing, and delivering that value to their different stakeholders now, which stakeholders now are not just stakeholders in that they are, that have stock ownership, but customers and business partners as well.
I really do love your story, and I'm a huge proponent of, I guess, like the full circle life, you know, like where you mm-hmm. kind of see everything go from like things that happen earlier on, you never realize how valuable they become, you know, later on in your life or in different aspects. But the one thing, I guess, so you mentioned both your parents were entrepreneurs. So from that standpoint alone, you got a chance to see, like, from even just a small business, that if you're not, pretty much, if you're not adding any value to your general customers, that, like, that's a sink or swim kind of moment, where yes. if it's nothing that they are benefiting from, you know, that's pretty much the health of your overall business. So I guess, like, with your background of seeing your parents being entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. also from your business aspect of seeing how much it is important to see value, do you think a lot of this attributed to the reason why you have held leadership roles, or like this way that you pursue leadership roles?
It's very interesting. If I can go back to the learnings of because my parents were entrepreneurs, I saw how they interact with the customers and how they really made the customer seem like they were part of the family. And that was very important. And it didn't matter of you know, the race, culture, or anything. They accepted everyone. And I learned that very early of growing up. And seeing the diversity and the culture and acceptance of everyone. But the lesson that I also learned, you also learn through mistakes, mm-hmm. right? And it's very interesting, because I told you that my parents were in this commercial ovens business, and they were big, gigantic, big ovens, right? And they would break down a lot, and so it was a lot of repair that had to be done. And so my dad and I think my brothers also joined them in some capacity. They had a lot of work, a lot of business. But technology change came in. And those big ovens all of a sudden became small, compact, very efficient, automated in some ways, in a lot of ways, I would say. And so they didn't really have a big need to have someone come in and put the oven together, right? To build it, to construct it. which was very time consuming, but and when you're in a service driven type of business, that's great. but because it was smaller, you didn't really need to have, you could have more of them in the room. And more importantly, they were much more robust. And so my dad knew that this was coming. And instead of looking at ways of adapting it, I should say, he kind of, maybe he ignored it, maybe he thought it wasn't going to take off as fast as it did, that he'll still have some time, or maybe he'll find another extension off of that. But that was a very, very stressful and time, because, and it really taught me that in our business, it's technology, especially the only thing that really you can count on technology is that it's going to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Right?
And so what I saw is that from a business standpoint, and even what we're going through now, we're seeing that Rivalry even is shifting from even well-defined industries that used to deliver clear products and services to a broader ecosystem, right? Is they now need to deliver and expand their value proposition, right? For example, cars, the car manufacturers are now looking at becoming more, providing mobility solutions. Mm-hmm. Right? Banking are now transforming or being disrupted by the fintech platforms, right? Pharmacies are now being transformed by into health management centers, right? So from production lines to intelligent factories, industry boundaries are now collapsing everywhere you look. And the trend is just accelerating, right? I see car manufacturers now talking about selling insurance. Mm-hmm. I see ADP who basically is a payroll company, right? They provide payroll services. They're offering banking services now and putting them out there in the banking ecosystem, right? And so they're transforming, becoming a different type of company, right? And so what the good news is, that is software that's enabling a lot of that for us. But what it's saying is that the traditional way of approaching that business is different, right? And ironically, I don't know if you remember, but there was a Bloomberg Business Week cover. I think it was June 2015. Unfortunately, I don't have that prop.
Sorry.
But I wish I did, because at the front, it said was, it just showed computer code. And I don't know what language it was. It didn't even matter, because it said on the front, also down at the bottom, if you can't read this, you better read this essay.
That's deep.
Basically what they said was, is that, and this was 2015, I believe. They basically said that no matter where, even in leadership roles, even at the CEO level, if you do not understand the concept of coding, of the software and coding and aspects of that, you're going to struggle as a leader. And to your point, I got into product management and more of the leadership type roles by accident. It was fully by accident. I mean, a quick funny story. It was, I remember I was at a, it was one of the companies that I worked for, and I went and sat down in the cafeteria, and I was so excited because I just checked in my code, and for all intents and purposes, let's say I checked in this new blue button, right? And I was okay. So excited about this new blue button. And I sat down next to a table with a gentleman that I never didn't know. It was the cafeteria for the company, and introduced myself. And I said, "He said, how you doing today?" I said, "Oh, I'm doing great. I just finished this pro. I just finished my blue button." And the guy said, so you work in that organization that supplies that software for us. I said, yep. And we just got this new blue button. And he's like, well, you know, we really needed a green button. And we need some improvements on the red button. We kind of really need a blue button. And that, to me, immediately said, wow, there is a disconnect, right? And I needed to get closer to understanding that customer. In other words, I needed to get closer to the business. And so that really kind of got me going down that product management road, because I was able to, it gave me the opportunity to work more closer to the customers, understand what their issues are, figuring out how technology can now simplify their lives and not be an impediment to them. And that also gave me the opportunity to learn other parts outside of just the development, but operations as well. So I was able to be exposed to best practices in operations. Back then, it was something called ITIL, but now SREs is a big thing, cyber reliability engineers. But it gave me that holistic look, but it gave me a set of best practices and principles. But more importantly, I got to see how the changes in business, how things were changing in the business side, it was connected to the changes that needed to happen on the technology side as well. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it was holistic end to end, had different control points, but essentially that was the value stream to me. And then that got me down the path to really understand that from a more academic academic world as first from the theoretical, and then putting it to practice, and it has been amazing from there.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I love how you brought up like how you identified that lack, that disconnect, or that lack of communication, because I think that's one thing we've all identified. Well, I think we've all kind of been there where you just get it as a developer, you just get a ticket and you're like, oh, I'm gonna do a great job on this ticket. Mm-hmm. But then you realize the PM or the product owner didn't communicate or didn't misunderstood the end user, right? Or,
yes.
or the requirements. And so
yeah.
You get in, you get through code review, and it's like all that work, and then it's like, oh, well, this is not really what we needed. So that does hurt. So you kind of like, you hold that feeling. You say you don't want to do that to others. So that's to me, that communication and identifying requirements is an underutilized skill set. Are there any other skills that us as developers or anyone else in the engineering space, any other skill sets we can look to gain or utilize in order to improve that DevOps philosophy, I'll call it, as Gene Kim would like to say, the philosophy behind DevOps and the Agile movement? Is there any other skill sets you think us and our listeners should kind of like focus on to help better facilitate that process? Because a lot of times as developers, sometimes we just focus on the code, and sometimes sometimes we're hearing things from the PMs and we're hearing things from the product owners, and we don't communicate those things back to them, but we're a part of that communication process. Yes. Too. So maybe we should sometimes I feel as though we don't speak up enough in that process when we're just given that ticket. So
yes.
Any other skill sets you can identify from your lessons for improving?
Yes. I think definitely the skill set around like you mentioned and be skillful around coding is fantastic, right? But again, technology is a broad term, right? There are many aspects of responsibilities and that require the technical expertise, but they're not always equate to what you imagine, right? Because there are roles available in technology that vary from company to company. And contrary to myth, I found the soft skills like communication, collaboration, critical thinking, being flexible, always willing to learn and to even go outside of your space a little bit, right? But really, keys that I saw when I mentored a junior programmers, that a lot of them moved into, like you mentioned, a product management role, or they were like, hey, you know, I really like this product management or product owner role, or I want to go ahead and understand more around other responsibilities and areas within the Scrum team. And it was so amazing. And I even worked in a program where Van Jones, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he worked in the Obama administration, and he's now a CNN contributor. But I knew him when he ran, and I think he still has this nonprofit, it's called Dream Corp. And what they would do is they would offer training to folks that, especially he would target maybe certain communities that needed skill sets. And he was also a big green jobs supporter as well. So I would volunteer for his organization. And that's where I got exposed to lots of different folks who were former teachers. And these teachers became some of the most incredible QA leads and program leads and they ended up teaching, of course, it's like Scale Agile and SAFe and being certified. So it's multiple avenues that you can have as far as getting into this technology space. And as a developer, I think you have that unique perspective of having that skill set and being able to take that skill set and then also expand it into, I would say, more the business side, because I think what's happening, or the trend that I'm seeing now, is that the business functions like sales, legal, finance, they're becoming more operationalized. And through technologies like low code, they're starting to become a value delivery. They're starting to have value delivery capabilities within their organization, but they don't have, the full discipline around the coding that a developer that went through that process similar to me had. Right. So don't be afraid to go working in the legal ops space and domain. I did that, and two of my PMs were attorneys, former attorneys. So it's blending, and so it's like I said, the only change, the only constant in the tech industry is change. And so the advice I would really give is that it's kind of like this quote from Wayne Gretzky. He was this hockey player, and someone asked, "What's your secret of success?" And he said, "Well, you know, I skate to where I think the puck is going to be, and not to where the puck is now." Right?
That's deep.
So that means I'm constantly learning, right? I'm continuously learning. # still learning, right? And being exposed to other aspects, like I mentioned, around tech, read about fintech, med tech, and sales ops and insurance. I mean, I have a friend in insurance that used low code, and they learned a little bit of C#, and they're a claims officer, but they mapped out the value stream of the process, identified the gaps, and then they built mini apps that are now driving new revenue streams for the company, essentially becoming a value creator right then and there, right? So it's definitely an excellent time to have that skill set. And I think now is the time to really really expand out, because it's a lot of people say that companies are becoming software companies. And I disagree there. I think what's happening is that companies are not becoming software companies. Actually, the successful, even the successful software companies, really they're business companies that have a defined purpose, mission, vision, and they just happen to use software to help them deliver that mission as a measurable outcome that translates to value for their customers. That's really what is happening. So what that means to you is, if you also know your purpose, that will guide you to success as well.
I like that.
I love that.
That was a lot. Definitely a lot of gems shared there. I know one of our last questions was about, you know, as far as young technologists looking to start their career. And I kind of just want to unpack a lot of what you said, at least from what I heard, is that we're in a time where I think this bubble was already starting to somewhat burst. But COVID kind of definitely made it speed up, is that we're seeing, like you mentioned, we're seeing more companies like not only just stay within their realm, but also thinking more outside of the box of how do we expand. And so in terms of like a young technologist or even somebody getting started in tech, kind of from what I hear from you is that we all have to kind of mold the same business model for ourselves, which is that we're good at something that we do often. As you mentioned, the Bloomberg article, we need to learn how to code. We need to understand how computers work, because everything that we used to, I guess, do manually, and I think even more now, sort of more than ever, we've noticed where a lot of the stuff that we would do before, you know, just simple examples of doing things, and it's a process, it's a technology, you know, it's something, it's an app on our phone.
Yes.
But I guess, like, to even more expand on that, for somebody that is looking into getting a tech or starting a tech career, are there any other points that you would like to mention as far as like taking that first step? I know you said you taught yourself how to code, which again, that's amazing, because a lot of people have, you know, they struggle with that. Where do I start kind of thing?
Yes. It is amazing, because I see there's so many resources now available, because even when I guess 10 years ago, where I talked about that Dream Corp program, where we would go and teach, identify young students in high school coding. And now it's the resources, there's so many online and free resources now that can really help get you started down that path. And it could be daunting, right? So what I'm seeing now is so much, it could be daunting. It's like, where do I start? Where do I go, right? And so what I'm seeing is kind of this need of how can I really focus on and understand kind of the core basics, right? And you mentioned it very early, that was very important, where I think it's important to really understand the interaction between the software language and how that works with the hardware and how that interfaces and works together, right? I think it was a book that I read, because I worked at I did research at Microsoft. I actually worked on the Windows NT product line very early on. And so I got exposed to the Windows NT source code, and but it was great. I actually got a patent out of that for testing, because I had to test Windows NT running on different chipsets because I had a hardware background and also a software background. And what was amazing was, is that back then we would form communities and we would go to, I guess these clubs, I would say clubs, and we would meet after work and we would talk and basically share information and things of that nature. I'm sure there's events like that, or even they're all virtual. I would definitely start investigating that as well, because the quicker, one of the big changes for me that helped accelerate me in this direction was, again, that sacrifice that my dad made, not only buying this computer at an early age, but also getting me into this, having me be able to be exposed to other other folks, like-minded folks, like myself, and able to accelerate and learn and share information, right? So definitely don't be a loner in this. I know in this field, a lot of folks can be very, use it to just be kind of by themselves and things of that nature, but definitely use this as an opportunity to interact with others, because that's how you learn, that's how you grow, and that's how you start building a network. Because one of the things I discovered in Silicon Valley, working, because this is where we did this program, I did the program with Van Jones, is that in Silicon Valley, it's all about the network. Mm-hmm. It's the network, really. And I was blessed where I was part of that network. And so I had opportunities to interview at these Silicon Valley companies and to get positions at these companies and to work at startups and sell startups to large companies. So, but none of that would have been possible without building that network, right? And right now, I think LinkedIn is a perfect place to do that. And I think after in the program, I could leave my information if anybody wants to contact me, and I can send them links to other based upon their interests and what they want to do. I can help guide them into the different areas as well.
That's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely add all of that great information in the show notes, so we can all reach out to you. So this has been great, Eric. I appreciate everything.
No, thank you.
There's a bunch of gems here, but I do have one more final question to wrap it up, and I have to add one. Okay.
Sure.
So I hear Texas, I hear St. Louis. If we're going for a meal,
it depends.
It has a better barbecue sauce.
Yeah. And ironically,
you know what I'm going to, Clarence.
Barbecue. It depends on the type of barbecue. Because when I came to Texas, because I went to school here at the university, and they served. I was like, what is this that they're serving? And I started eating it. I was like, I love this. And they're like, it's brisket. I was like, what? Brisket? I never heard of brisket. I ribs. but not brisket. And so if you want brisket, Texas. If you want ribs,
change your life.
St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Okay. It depends. Now I see the defense. Gotcha. All right. Well, that's great. So thank you all for listening. Eric, thanks again for joining us. We're glad to have you into the Devs Like Us family now. We really appreciate you reaching out and taking time with us today. We can't express enough how much we appreciate it. So to the listeners, we know you had to get something out of that. So we really appreciate you all tuning in. And my name is Terrence.
I'm Clarence.
And I'm Eric. And thank you again, guys, for inviting me. This was fantastic. I loved it.
Yep, this has been awesome.
It was awesome. All right. Thank you.